Hi everyone, today is December 4th, 2020. My name is Hannah Sawyer and I am going to be talking to Irina Yakubovskaya for the COVID Disability Archive. These oral histories are being recorded as a way to document the lived experiences of disabled, chronically ill, and neurodivergent individuals during the COVID-19 pandemic across the world. Okay, thank you so much for being here with me, Irina. If you could start just by giving your name, age, pronouns, and where you live.
My name is Irina Yakubovskaya, and I'm 34 years old. My pronouns are she, hers, they is also fine. And I live in Watertown, Massachusetts currently. I reside in Watertown, Massachusetts.
Thank you. And next, how do you identify? So do you identify as disabled, chronically ill, neurodivergent, etc.? And then as on top of this, feel free to share any other identifiers that you would like to share as well.
Mm-hmm. So I don't particularly know. I'm still struggling with sort of putting myself on the spectrum of disability because I am chronically ill. I have chronic migraines, like super bad chronic migraines, basically every day. Nobody knows why they happen and all that. But that's not my primary issue or disabling chronic condition, I guess. So I was born with limb differences. And that really affected my life from the very beginning. But the thing about it is that I am able to conceal my limb differences for not as much for as a choice, but just because it's physically the only way I can like walk in more or less a healthy way, not healthy necessarily, but I mean. Is to conceal my differences, because if I don't, like, basically I can't not wear shoes or some covering on my feet because that would prevent me from moving, basically, right? So but that puts me in an interesting sort of position where for an untrained eye or for somebody who doesn't particularly pay attention, I may pass for them as an able-bodied person, but I'm not. And then the other issue, I do have other medical conditions that I was diagnosed with throughout my life, just a gift that keeps on giving. I don't know if they sort of put me in a disabled category or a chronically ill category, but yeah, I don't know. So sorry, this is a very confusing answer, but that's the question I've been struggling, and I'm sure I'm not alone with this, you know, struggling to kind of put myself not everyone's in a box, but something like that, right? Where I'm talking about how I identify. I, for myself, I know I am disabled. I know my experiences have been of a disabled person throughout my life in one way or another, but it doesn't mean that everybody I've ever crossed paths with have felt that they put me in that category.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to go ahead and move into the meat of the interview, talking mm-hmm. about your experience with the pandemic. So when did you first learn about the pandemic and what was your experience with that? So, you know, specifically if you remember where you were or specific emotions yeah. That you had when you first heard about this.
So I was working before the pandemic. I had multiple jobs, which was a big mistake. I was very tired. And one of my jobs was I was working at a coffee shop in Harvard Square. So, you know, Harvard is a very densely populated school, so to speak, and very various people come through. And somewhere in February, I want to say, of this year, we started getting the news, you know, in general from the television and whatnot about, you know, there's this virus, but we had so many tourists come through. And in general, you know, living in the city, like I live in Boston, essentially, so I commuted through public transit all the time. And gradually I started seeing more people with more colds and symptoms that were questionable. Then I got sick and I didn't know what I had, but it was early on. So I was like, so we were still sort of figuring out and not realizing it was very, you know, dangerous. So like I kept going to work and I kept commuting and like coughing and sneezing without having any severe symptoms. And I still don't know to this day if I actually had the early stages COVID version or maybe it was just a cold, you know, because it was the February in Boston. But in general, I remember, I think the way I learned about the pandemic really, and it like sunk in, you know, and kind of got to my mind that it was real, was when my jobs, both of them, my teaching job and my coffee shop job, started closing down. So, and that's the way I reacted to it was, for the coffee shop job, I was really happy it was happening, not the pandemic, but the fact that they were closing, because it was turning out to be a dangerous situation for everybody involved. And then for the teaching job, I felt, I also felt sort of relieved that some kind of action was being taken, you know, to support people or to prevent people from having to go to work in person, maybe. But I still think that the way that was handled in the US, at least, was very chaotic early on, especially, I mean, still, even now, right? But because people didn't really know how to proceed and there was not a very drastic set of actions taken immediately. So there was a difference in responses. So all of that combined made me feel a little bit confused and lost. And I felt like I had to rely on my own discretion and my own sort of common sense, I guess, right, to make a judgment whether to go outside or whether to go to work or refuse. So if that, hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. Where do you teach?
I taught at Emerson College, which is located directly downtown Boston, like in the epicenter of all the people, extremely busy, very tight quarters, so to speak. Like all the buildings are tall. They're very like tiny elevators. Just like also I had to take the bus and the train there. So all of that, because of the accessibility issue, like for me, like I don't drive. So I had to rely on public transit. And that was dangerous. And to be honest, later on during the summer, they contacted me and they said, would you like to, sorry, it's not funny, but it really kind of is. They were like, many professors will be teaching remotely because they have their accommodations, but we are asking from our adjunct professors, which was me and many, many others, to consider coming in to teach half of the classes in person, because the way they did the schedule for the fall was like a combination or something like that. So you would have half of the classes taught online, and then the second half of that particular course would be taught in person. And so they basically were saying, hey, would you like to come in person to teach this other half of the class that the actual professors don't want to teach? And I had to say no, which nobody blames me for, because it was basically like, I don't want to put my life in danger by having to take the bus, the train, and then walk through the busy town or city, whatever, of Boston, just to get to work where it's going to be, I don't even have benefits there. It's like literally super minimal payment. So it's not worth it in that sense. So, yeah.
So did you move to teach remotely?
Well, I don't have a job, technically. Okay. Like I have one student that I'm helping with. I'm doing like a directed study, independent study type of thing, but it's practically for free. And I've been unemployed officially since June. So.
Okay. So how has your experience with the pandemic changed since the beginning? So how has it changed over the course of this?
In the beginning, I tried to find some sort of curious or interesting elements of this whole stay-at-home business, which was exciting for a little bit, right? I remember having this sort of wave of, you know, oh, so much of my energy is now available to, more than usual, available to me, rather than I have to get up at 4:30 a.m., go to work and work an 8-hour shift at a coffee shop while destroying my health completely. Like, I should not have been doing that job, to be honest. It was really a bad idea. But and then taking a train and going to teach to classes and then coming home at like in the evening, completely destroyed. I mean, so that lifestyle was not sustainable even before the pandemic. And when it kind of gradually ended, it was sort of a blessing in disguise in that sense. So I felt in the first several months of the pandemic, I felt like the energy opened up and became more available to me. So I started, and I had been already thinking about switching careers because academic world is not really something I want to stay in, because also it doesn't really have any much going on in terms of jobs, as you may know. So I had been already thinking about it. So the pandemic kind of prompted this pause for me in which I took a second to reflect on what I actually want to do and if I even deserve to be doing what I want to do, which is a big question always. And so I started doing more art. I started doing more creative things. I went back to painting more and to do more visual art. So, and then I focused on sort of on my own professional development, and I allowed myself to take time and make a website for myself and work on different things and like just practice things that I feel like I could be good at. And so that took several months. Like during the first several months into the summer, I was very, almost not ecstatic, but, you know, appreciative rather of the good that came out of this. And then, but that was also because I didn't know how long this was going to last. So I felt like, well, if it lasts all the way into winter, then it's terrible. But I kind of felt like maybe it was not going to happen. Well, big mistake. Here we are. And so I think gradually I went through the waves of, you know, oh, I'm so sad. I'm so sad because nothing, like I can't find a job. Nothing's happening. And then my health deteriorated further in terms of my chronic pain and other issues. Like they keep discovering some other medical conditions in me. Like I said, the gift that keeps on giving. And so I had to go to several new doctors to see specialists and do tests, which you may imagine became very expensive. And I, like I said, I'm unemployed. So I basically had to like make these choices, you know, gradually. Oh, but how do I try and take care of my health as much as I can? Or do I just let it go for now because I literally don't have the resources to support that, you know? And so that's been quite difficult to choose between, like how to decide. But now at this point, honestly, I'm in this position right now where I have not received my unemployment benefits in 6 weeks because there was some kind of mistake on their side and it's been just on hold. So I'm in a position where I just don't even know, like, what's going to happen next week, you know. I hope I'm not going to be on the street. I think I can rely on my partner to not let that happen, but it's becoming more and more nerve-wracking to me in terms of, you know, how do I move on? Like what I feel a little bit helpless in that regard, you know. But also to go back to the question of like how it changed, and I do realize that yes, the pandemic is absolutely terrifying because it keeps happening. And of course, now I know more people who had the virus, especially overseas, because I'm from Russia and over there it's just the end of the world in that sense. So it's been very stressful on that side of my life. But I think now I'm just more real. I'm realizing that I have to prioritize even better what to take care of in terms of my everyday life. Like, do I take care of trying to eat something, you know, or because I'm so ill, I can't. Or the other day, actually, that maybe goes into your next question or one of the next questions, but it's an experience I think I should share. I had an appointment I've been trying to get an appointment with with my headache specialists, and they basically are withholding my medication from me, refuse to prescribe it further until they see me in person. And I had to be on the phone with them for hours begging them to not do this. And I negotiated with them finally to take to do an online appointment with me, because I said I physically cannot get there. I cannot walk there because it's quite far away. I cannot take the public transit because this is dangerous right now. It's like, what do you want me to do? And they're like, we just need your vitals. And I'm like, I'm not going to risk my life to get you my vitals. It's just not going to happen. But how are we, you know? So I begged them and I cried, you know, not intentionally, but I mean, so hopefully that worked out. So they were able to negotiate the online appointment with me, but I had to get my records from another doctor to send to them so that, you know what I mean? So all of that, it's a lot of management, but it's just so, that day when I found out that they wanted me to come in person, I was devastated. I thought, you know, how unfair it is that I have to basically beg for basic medical care that I deserve. And I was terrified about how I was going to survive this week, because usually when I have very bad headaches, which are happening more often than not nowadays, in the normal world, I would just go to the ER, which I have done in the past. Now I can't even do that. So I, every day, you know, I worry that I'm going to have this terrific headache that was going to just put me on the floor, and I'm going to be unable to do anything about it. And that is scary. So.
Yeah, that's really scary. And yeah, there's someone that I interviewed 2 nights ago who was talking about, she called it decision fatigue, and just that, you know, draining, the way that not knowing what to do or trying to make sort of an impossible choice or an impossible decision throughout all of this has been really difficult for her. That sounds very similar. Okay, so what has your experience been as someone who is disabled and who has these various health issues? What has your experience been as a disabled person and chronically ill person throughout the pandemic? I know you've already touched on this a little bit, but if you feel like expanding on that.
You know, weirdly enough, I feel like I'm going to shift to a more positive gear, I guess, maybe if I can. I don't even know if I can. But I think, interestingly enough, I feel like this time has allowed me to come to terms with my disabled identity. Because I've been thinking about how throughout my life, I've had multiple careers or career directions and education, all that. So I've tried so many different things professionally, and I also moved from so far away. I changed my life so many times, like drastically, you know, started over. So I feel like throughout all these changes in my life, the only part of my identity that's been constant has been my disability. And I'm 34, so it took me a while, but I feel like I'm really starting to embrace it. And I have been paying more attention, not just superficially, but for real, to the disability discourse that goes on social media in different channels, different groups. And I've been trying to participate, but not, you know, too much, or to the extent that I'm comfortable, basically. In other words, even a year ago, I don't think I would have reached out to you or responded to the Twitter, I think it was, right? The question that was sent out. Just because I didn't feel like it was my place, or I didn't feel like I had a place in the community. And it's me, it's not the community, you know. And again, I'm sure that many people struggle with similar thoughts. But to me now, I still feel like I have obviously a lot to learn, a lot to embrace, a lot to negotiate sort of within myself. But the other element of that, my positionality as an immigrant in this country, in the US, has made it more difficult for me to openly claim disabled identity, because it really scares me, especially with the still current administration, right? It really scares me to speak out. Because legally on paper, I don't have a disability on paper. Like, I don't collect disability benefits, for example, right? But, and that's because even when I still lived in Russia, which I did for 23 years of my life, over there, everything is so corrupt. To get disability benefits, my mother had to beg them every year to renew them and do some humiliating things. She never told me what, but she said she stopped doing that because she just couldn't anymore, just because the system is designed against people, period, right? So so when I moved here, I never even gave it a thought. And then as an immigrant, it's a very tricky sort of place to be in, because you, as a person who can conceal, so to speak, right, or pass as able-bodied as myself, majority of the time, on paper, I feel like I have the privilege of not disclosing on paper when it comes to immigration papers or what have you, right? Like applying for a green card and all that stuff, because especially now they have the public charge rule, which is a total just travesty. It's terrible, right? And so you always, even though I feel like in this country people are in general somewhat more protected by the law-ish, hopefully, right? But at least there's a hope of that. I still feel like I don't want to be in a situation where I give the wrong people, whoever is doing paperwork in the government, any reason to claim some sort of non-existent, jeopardizing element to my presence. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have to explain this. Anyway, that was a very convoluted way of explaining that. Up until very recently, until the election, to be honest with you, like the day of the election, or, you know, the week of when it was pretty much clear that things went somewhat well, I felt like such a huge weight just dropped from my shoulders, because I felt like, maybe there's hope for me that I can be more outspoken about who I am without constantly being terrified that I'm going to get a letter or something, you know? Anyway. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, it does. What is the public charge rule that you mentioned?
It's a fun one. No. So the way I understand it, I'm not a legal expert of any kind, but the way I understand it is, especially this administration kind of changed a lot of immigration rules, and it became at some point part of the immigration process you have to declare whether you think you will at any point become a public charge to this country. And I think it was literally like finalized and solidified somewhere, maybe like a year ago or two. I can't remember. But I felt, even though I already had my conditional green card, which is a green card you get if you get married or through family, and then if they verify that your marriage is real, which again, is another whole nother process. But I remember going to that interview with my spouse. They interviewed it separately, and they asked her a question, like, do you foresee yourself being a public charge? And I said, no, because I honestly don't. But it's, you know what I mean? I kept thinking, they don't read me as a disabled or chronically ill person in this moment, and that is a privilege that I have in this particular moment, because they don't question or don't jeopardize that, you know, my existence in that sense. Does it make sense? So yeah. I think for me, right, like I still don't know how that's going to affect me if I ever, you know, if my health deteriorates if even further in the future, or should I say when it does, because, you know, I'm not getting younger, it goes the other way. But I think, yeah, I'm just trying not to think about it as much anymore. But it used to really freak me out, just because being from a paranoid country where, well, the government is out to get you all the time, right? I always felt like, oh, I need to be worrying about this. And none of the people I know, none of the people who are American and who are able-bodied, none of them understand what I mean. To be honest, they kind of don't quite get it. So,
yeah. So just to clarify, so I make sure I understand.
Yes.
Public charge means, like if you end up needing like assistance, health benefits from the government.
I think yes, but also okay. The way I understand it, it goes to basically say, in this particular case, like if you think you will be claiming disability benefits in the future.
Got it.
Because at this point, this particular administration framed it in a way that applies even to like food stamps, okay, right? And stuff like that. So, but again, I don't know. I'm not a legal expert, but just the thought of it makes me terrified. So
absolutely. Yeah. So it sounds like there's, it sounds like you've had this, you know, you've been able to come to terms with this specific part of your identity. And yet there's been always this like background fear of what mm-hmm. claiming that identity would mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So how has your disability impacted how you have dealt with the pandemic?
Well, I mentioned already, I am unable to get places like doctor's offices and such. So when choosing a medical specialist, I always make sure that it's walkable, like reasonable, within like a mile or something, which is pretty hard to do. Because I really don't go outside at all. And I definitely, when I do go outside for whatever reason, for longer than 20 minutes or something, for like a larger distance, I really feel like there's I feel it in my body, you know, it feels like it hurts more, and all these different areas, which are, problematic. But also, so in that sense, it impacted my ability to access certain places. It impacted in terms of my, you know, mental health. I'm sure everybody can relate to that. I used to, whenever I felt blue or something back in the day when we could travel to a city that you live in, I would just, you know, take a train or a bus and go hang out in Boston, sit on a bench or something. I can no longer do that. And that has been a very tough experience for me mentally. In terms of my headache, a chronic pain thing, it's been really bizarre because it just, like I said, it's completely unknown. The origin is unknown. Maybe it's alien. I'm not sure. That would explain so much. but it's been really difficult to sort of, because when it gets very bad and I have it almost every day, it's very much debilitating. I can't stand. I can't think. Sometimes I get very nauseous. It's like the worst migraine symptoms all at once. And it's like 110%. It's pretty bad. And I get, it affects my ability to apply for jobs. It affects my ability to do what I'm trying to do. Like I'm taking online classes to learn graphic design and to learn online marketing and some kind of applicable skills, because I have a master's degree and I have a PhD, but it's not helping me right now, you know? So doing that kind of work, or even I've done a lot of like service writing. Like I volunteer for the website where I write, and, or I did this book review recently, and it's like, it takes a lot of effort for me to even look at the screen, like when I have a headache, let alone edit the text, right? So it impacted my ability to produce a coherent work. Period. It even affected my ability to produce art, because I'm an artist. Like it's my hobby / I do have an Etsy shop, but it's not really, like, it's not my primary income of any part. You know, I do sell my paintings, but they're not. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying I'm a professional artist, but I've tried making paintings when I had headaches, and I had to throw them away because it just felt like I was twisting my soul into something that came out of, you know, tremendous pain. So it affected a lot of my experiences in all directions. The other thing is, what did I want to say? See? Memory is funny. I forgot. I'm sorry. It'll come back to me.
Oops, I muted myself. Yeah, that's totally fine. Yeah, and I should have said this at the beginning, but you know, you can like not look at the screen if that's better for you.
Look at you.
Okay.
I love your pigtail thing. It's adorable. Yeah.
So yes, and also I want to make sure, I would love to get a link to your Etsy shop. That's
really, thank you. Yeah, I'll send it to you.
Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned that, you know, before all of this started, you were able to, for example, like take public transit, to mm-hmm. Boston, downtown Boston, do these different things. So I just want to make sure I fully understand. So before the pandemic hit, you were able to get outside of your apartment more, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I also had to do that because my work was in Harvard Square. And it's like there's a bus that goes from my house to Harvard Square and then a train that I took from Harvard Square to Boston.
Got it.
And yeah, but that was like the last year or so. And before that, I was at Tufts getting my PhD, which is in Medford. I don't know if you're familiar with this area. It doesn't matter. But it's basically all of that is pretty close by, like a couple of miles away. But because of the Boston terrible public transit, it takes like an hour and a half to go 5 miles on a bus or whatever. So, but I used to do a lot more when I was still in graduate school. I used to do like, because I didn't have a lot of friends or any really meaningful community of any kind. So I would just go and hang out in Boston, even before I worked in Boston.
Okay. Okay. So what have your relationships with people been like throughout this? And have they changed in any ways?
People. What are those? So I didn't really have a lot of friends, period. Before the pandemic, I was trying really hard, too hard, to bond with my coffee shop crew. And despite the fact that we had like 10 plus year difference and all of them, most of them were, you know, much younger and just in a different mindset. And I tried to fit in so hard. It was pathetic. But so that was a lot of, you know, social pressure that I kind of inflicted upon myself. I have kind of lost touch with most people from grad school because my graduate school was not a pleasant experience in any way. Big surprise. And I basically stayed in touch with one particular friend who's also an immigrant. And we've been, you know, texting more and phone call or Zoom calling, whatever. I have had multiple hangout sessions with my best friends from Colorado, where I used to live. And we've done that. We had like a group text going since the pandemic started. So that's been very supportive. Sometimes it's just good to vent or, you know, to send funny pictures to a group of friends who, you know, love you no matter what. I also, maybe this is too personal, but, you know, who cares? No such thing. I think my relationship with my spouse has improved. It was never bad in the first place, but prior to the pandemic, we were both extremely busy and we would both come home. He would come home from his work and I would come home from my works. And we would be just so completely exhausted. And it's just like didn't have any time or energy to pay attention to anything, each other. We would hang out with the cat. Obviously, the cat is very important. I would show the cat, but she's sleeping somewhere and I don't want to wake up the beast. But since the pandemic, we really bonded even more, me and my spouse. And it allowed us to have, you know, more profound conversations, sort of to become more supportive of each other in whatever shape or form. And I don't know, I think it really made our marriage stronger, which is such a weird thing to say. I'm not really a monogamy supportive person or whatever. Like, it's not really sort of my mindset at all. But in general, I feel like, yeah, before the pandemic, my personal sort of play, the way I felt like I was being part of a marriage just felt really chaotic and as if I didn't process it well enough when it happened or something. Do you know what I mean? And then now I feel like we've had a different type of, because we got together when we were in graduate school and everything was just a mess. And then since the pandemic, we were able to kind of zoom in into our own relationship and find that spot where we feel both like we don't want to hang out with anybody and we can't. So that's a good thing. And I do appreciate that I was able to open up more and be more authentic with my partner in regards to how I'm feeling, like physically and emotionally. And to be honest, this person, my spouse, was the first person who even suggested that I incorporate my disabled identity into my life more. Because he always, you know, said, he encouraged me to even present at a conference, specifically with a do a presentation focusing on disability and on my experience as a disabled person. So that's been even better since the pandemic.
Wow, yeah, that's really great. So have you had to, like distance yourself from people at all, due to perhaps like how different people are approaching the pandemic? Mm-hmm. Or would you say that that hasn't really changed?
Yes and no. So on one hand, in a physical space, the only people we are ever in proximity to are people who live in the same house. They have a different apartment, but in the same house. So they spend time in the basement quite a lot, and I spend time in the basement when I paint. So that's been, and we're not friends with them. I'll just leave it at that. And it's been a bit frustrating to, you know, have to wear a mask to go to my own basement. I got a face shield just in case. Like, I want to make sure, like, I want to, like, sanitize everything on my side of the basement, like, just in case, you know. So I basically have to take that. I don't have to, but I choose to take those steps, you know, just to make sure that there is no more risk than necessary. So that physical distancing has been sort of annoying, but I'd rather do it than not, you know. And then so basically I wear the mask at any point where I'm outside of my door, like whether it's on my porch or something, like just I don't want to risk anybody's safety. Emotionally and socially, I've been, like I said, I'm from Russia originally, and I don't particularly talk to many people there anymore. I talk to my family there, but it's been difficult to see so many people over there over the course of several months now, just completely disregard all the precautions and post these Instagram pictures as if nothing's happening. And then it was the funniest and the saddest, but also the funniest thing in a way. One girl was telling me, we like talk all the time or often about art and making art, whatever. And she was telling me how she didn't really respect any of the precautions. And I was like, but it's silly. And she was like, well, everybody in my family had it and most of my friends have it. So whatever. And I'm like, are you kidding? And then she got it and she was like, oh yeah, now I have it. And I'm like, and no, but in the, doesn't bother anybody. Like, are you just all okay with it? And many people I know have knowingly broken protocol of all kinds and basically disregarded all the precautions, then got sick, are still sick. And they're kind of like, well, it is what it is. So that's been a bit difficult for me to process just because I just don't understand. And it's people I love and care about. You know, it's not some strangers that I could just yell at, you know, on Twitter or something. Not that I do that. I don't even do that. But it's just been baffling. That's the word. Because I do not understand. I cannot understand. And so I guess in that sense, my distancing from them has been, you know, I had to make a choice. Do I support them because I don't want them to like die? Or do I just ignore because they kind of brought it on themselves? You know what I mean? It's one thing when you get sick accidentally or something, but it's another thing when you purposefully go out, not wear masks and say the virus is not real or whatever. And it's like, oh, anyway, so that's been difficult to reconcile. And in terms of proximity or frequency of communication, I've been really, really communicating a lot with my parents. Well, with my mother, who is in the United States, but she is like on the phone with Russia 24/7, essentially. So she's physically here, but don't know where she's somewhere in between, probably mentally. And her husband, my stepfather, so they live in California right now, and they've been going through, he's also disabled, and they've been going through a lot of, you know, issues of their own, like losing jobs and trying to survive and being afraid because they're obviously my parents, so they're older, right? So they're definitely a more of a risk group. And supporting them has been a struggle because at this point I had to really relearn how to indicate my boundaries, because at this point the whole world to some degree needs support, right? And there's so much we can do, even for the people we love the most. So at some point I just had to tell them, you know, I love you guys, but if you call me to vent about how you can't find a job, I will support you, but I can't listen to it all the time because I'm literally in the same spot and I cannot do anything. I can't even send you money because I literally have no money. Like, I don't have the resources, not emotionally, but otherwise, you know, to provide to you. And let's just make sure that we don't freak each other out for no reason, because this is not the time, you know?
Yeah. So do you still have family in Russia?
Yeah, my mom is here. Okay. And like I said, she mentally is there. Right. Her husband is also Russian, also is here. And then everybody else is there.
Okay.
All my grandparents, my biological father, who I could care less for, but, you know, he, I guess, exists. And my uncle, my cousins. My mom has been trying to make me talk to them more. And I'm like, I can't. Like, I don't. They're not my children. I don't, you know, I'm not going to force. And that's, it doesn't just apply to children in general. Like, I don't feel like I'm obligated to talk to somebody who doesn't talk to me, you know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So from your perspective, do you feel like those people or people that you know in Russia, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to ask is the way that people are approaching the pandemic, and I don't mean, you know, on like a governmental level, but just, you know, everyday people, how do you feel like there's a difference in those who you know in Russia versus people you know here, or does it seem about the same?
I don't know personally anybody here who is actively breaking protocol and quarantine rules. I'm happy to say I'm not familiar with those individuals in person. I know they exist. I see them on the streets whenever I'm outside, but I don't know who they are and I don't want to know who they are. And therefore I don't want to know their reasoning, right? For the people in Russia that I'm familiar with, I know that my grandparents are barricaded in the house and we've been begging them not to leave and they've been fine with it. But I think they are the only two people I know who are Russian, who are in Russia and who don't give up on the whole situation. Everybody else, my 96-year-old grandmother, the other one, like I have one and a half sets of grandparents, she on the phone was telling me how she doesn't care because she's got immunity for the virus. She's 96. And I was like, I give up. I can't. I just can't. And then, so, you know, and then that's an extreme example, right? She's old. Who knows what's going on in her head, right? So, but the other people, like younger people, my age and a little bit younger, it's baffling. They just don't. They don't care. Like I said, you know, I tried explaining, being like, hey, you know, when you don't wear a mask, it doesn't harm just you, it harms everybody else who you may not even know. You go on a train, you cough on somebody, and then they're gone the next day and you will never know. And they just don't hear it. I don't know how to explain it. It's just a complete, it's not like an active, you know, subversion of the rules as it is here or appears to be most of the time. It's more of just a complete oblivion. People are oblivious. And then the other part of it is that I keep seeing on the social media, you know, all these people who post like news about some famous people dying in Russia, famous actors, famous theater. Because I come from a theater background. And so a lot of my connections, or at least social media connections, are Russian theater artists. Because I just can't help, I can't bring myself to deleting them all. I probably will. they post about all these, the Russian great artists dying and they're old. And it's like, they don't say why they die and how they die, but I'm pretty sure most of the time, because of the frequency of how it's happening now, I'm pretty sure most of them die probably from COVID, because I know that the hospitals in Russia are completely full. There's absolutely, they're in my hometown, which is not Moscow, it's a smaller town, but it's completely, there are no medications anywhere. You can't even find the, what do you call it, the thing you put on the finger to measure your oxygen level.
Oh, yeah, the pulse ox, I think.
That something, yeah. That thing. They can't even find that. Nothing is available. The doctors just don't come to you. If you call 911 or whatever, they just don't show up. It's literally like, it's just, there's nothing people can do. So people just kind of forget about it and give up and walk around and post beautiful pictures with their children, but no masks in the vicinity. And I wonder. Yep.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
But just to add to that, sorry, just to add,
sure. No,
before I forget, the most stressful part about this whole, like, how it's treated in Russia right now and how difficult and different it is that travel is becoming just basically a death sentence. Basically, not for me personally, like I don't have the resources to go anywhere right now, right? I haven't been in Russia in 11 years almost. I moved here to go to graduate school, and there's that. So before the pandemic, I had hopes to maybe save up at least some money to go there. Because it's like a big deal not being to your hometown, not seeing your family in 10 years. But now I know it will probably, I don't know when it's going to happen, both because of the pandemic, but also because of how it limited my ability to work and find work really in a sustainable kind of way. But in terms of travel, my mom is somebody who really needs to go and support her parents because they're very old and they need assistance, you know. And we talk about it almost every day. She is in this situation where she can't go because it's dangerous. She knows if she goes, she's going to probably pick up that virus on the way. It's a long trip, you know, from California to Russia. It's like halfway across the world. And she knows she's probably going to bring the virus there, and then she's going to have to quarantine herself, hopefully recover. Even if she doesn't become sick, she's still going to be a risk factor, you know. So it's like this, and I'm sure hundreds of millions of people around the world are in the same position where you've been separated from your family already for whatever reason, but now it's even more just terrifying every day what to do if something happens there, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that is such a difficult place to be in. And it sort of feels like, again, that idea of like, you know, what is the right choice here? And like, trying to figure that out. Absolutely.
Yep.
Okay. So has your current living situation been impacted at all by the pandemic?
Sorry, I'm smiling. I don't even know why. I mean, I got to laugh. Well, yes and no. So yes, I'm fortunate that I still have a roof over my head. It is unfortunate that I'm still unable to find a job. And at this point, because of the unemployment benefits that stopped coming for this stupid mistake thing, it's basically, I really hope that something will figure itself out somehow within the next 2 months at the most. Because my spouse does not have the resources to pay our tremendous rent, Boston, obviously, and just support us throughout, because that's just not doable. The other issue is because we're at home all the time, well, I am, he goes to work, but his office is empty, so it's fine for now. But again, like, he'll probably come back to work from home because we anticipate further lockdowns. We have these neighbors who have two children, and they have, you know, just basically loud all the time for one way, reason or another. So that's been an issue more so recently during the pandemic than before the pandemic. They were already loud before the pandemic, but at least we went outside and we were elsewhere during the day. You only had to deal with it in the evening or something. Now it's just all, so like, it's been really difficult to do anything really. We've lost countless hours of sleep because of this, and they just refuse to. We went and knocked on their door to say to turn the music down, and they yelled at us and said they will call the police on us. It's like, whatever, it's fine. So, and we were even looking for a place to relocate, even temporarily, just like, you know, because so that my husband could afford to support us. But moving right now is also sort of this, how do you even move in the pandemic? You can't ask for it, like, for help from anybody. Like, I can't lift many things. Like, how is this going to work? This is not going to work. So we're just going to have to figure it out, I guess. But in that sense, it's been impacted in terms of the, yeah. But I am fortunate and thankful that I still have a place to live. It could have been better. And I hope it gets better. Yeah. But I think in terms of the kind of circumstances around all of that, I think for me individually, if and hopefully when I find some kind of job, hopefully it will create a sort of a better resource for me to just feel like I don't have to look for a solution all the time, you know?
Yeah, just like a more of a sense of security, I'm sure.
Yeah, or some sort of stability, even temporary. Yeah. So,
absolutely. Okay, so do you feel like your relationships with different institutions have changed throughout all of this? So, for example, healthcare, government, the media, mm-hmm. etc.
Yes. First, I think the media in the past 4 years or five, even, right, because of the political situation, has been a constant source of anger and frustration, the media and the world. And now I feel like throughout the pandemic, I have used my skills that I have from my research background and just, you know, educational background and socio-political background. I use my skills to filter out certain attitudes and informations, because I think it can be very overwhelming to just absorb everything. I'm a bit of an empath, unfortunately, for everybody. And so I've been practicing I've been kind of building the filter system that doesn't let all of it in immediately, because that's too much. And, you know, because sometimes I just can't filter things out, and then it just, it affects me physically. It's so overwhelming. So in that sense, my relationship to the media has been more moderated, or in the past several months or so. So I appreciate that I took time to filter or to monitor my consumption of media, just because I can't do it all at once. I can't. And then the government, you know, as I mentioned before, my positionality as an immigrant is very peculiar in that sense. So I don't particularly have a direct relationship with the government outside of them giving me, or me applying for paperwork, them approving paperwork or not. I mean, obviously it's changed. I've never thought that I would be on unemployment, because I always had some kind of job going, because I had to as an immigrant, just as a student, especially before I became a permanent resident, I had to be a full-time student. Otherwise I would be deported. So I always had to maintain some kind of, all of that was, you know, and I didn't have any resources. So I had to have a job within the university, so it's legal, but so I can support myself. So, but long story short, I never thought I would be on unemployment, just because I never really thought about it. And so I'm glad I had this option. I'm glad I was legally allowed to, you know, apply for unemployment and get it. I mean, except for the past month and a half when they just kind of stopped randomly. So there's that. But in terms of the medical institutions, with the additional number of medical conditions that people keep discovering in me, I think I have an account with every hospital in Boston at this point, which is saying a lot, because there are many hospitals in here. So that's been interesting. I've, you know, as any person with a chronic illness or any disabled person, we know how, and also not men, we know how tremendously difficult it can be to advocate for ourselves in the medical environment. I have been so exhausted by just like the ignorance and the I've been told so many times, oh no, you just have panic attacks. You're an emotional person. And I'm like, I'm shaking. And anyway, it's a neurological disease. Like, what do you want from me? You know? So all of that, I've had all of that happen many times. I do think that I have learned that persistence cannot be substituted by anything else. And I have to be persistent. Unfortunately, as annoying as it is, I have to keep advocating for myself. Like, no one else is going to call the doctor and say that I refuse to come in person because it's dangerous for me, or I physically cannot, right? Like, I have to do that work, and it's exhausting emotionally and otherwise, but I have to do it. The interesting thing about it is that I think I have, I have embraced my right to choose who takes care of me, if that makes any sense, which is a huge privilege, sort of, I guess, right? But what I'm saying is, in the past, I would just go to whoever was available, medical doctor or a mental health specialist, but I never was able to find the match. You know, it's so important to find a doctor who can understand you and actually take care of you. And I think I finally started relying less on random coincidences in that sense and more on my agency in choosing who is my caregiver. And I think that's been helpful. Like, I finally found a therapist that I actually enjoy working with and who actually is helping me. And that's been many years, you know, of just random, oh, whatever. And now I made an effort. I made a rubric, what has to happen in order for this person to work. And so it works out. The other thing is, yeah, I don't know. I think institutions in general, my huge beef is with the higher education institutions, because I have received and I have worked in higher education for 10 years, basically. And just looking at the dumpster fire that is the higher education right now, it is baffling to me how underappreciated people are in higher education. So basically what I'm saying is my relationship to the higher education institutions has been really tainted to the point of absolutely no return, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and do you feel that has been specifically impacted by perhaps their response to the pandemic?
Yeah. Yes, specifically how, you know, I'm not really judging much for the first several months of the pandemic, because everybody was kind of confused and didn't know what they were doing, but moving forward with this particular semester, I'm just very disappointed. And first of all, in schools opening at all, even for a hybrid learning plan, like, that's just not. I honestly thought, you know, why can't everybody just take a semester off? Can't we just pause this? Like, but unfortunately, I understand the systemic issues within it, how everything is so tied up with the money that goes into the higher education from, it's such a non-sustainable model. It's like, you can't rely on tuition money to maintaining your workers. Like, just not, that's wrong, you know. But anyway, I know this is all a different conversation, but basically all these systemic issues just became so apparent, and it also became very obvious which institutions were willing to jeopardize the lives and safety of their staff and faculty and students just so they could make basic amount of money. And I think, yeah, I just don't think it's worth it. My other issue is with the institutions of performing arts, specifically theater and film, because I have always been very upset at all of that for their hypocritical approach to diversity and inclusion. And now, you know, specifically when it comes to training programs of like performing arts and practices of performing arts, I've been very baffled by the response of people who got really confused. How do we teach acting online? Ooh, what a challenge. And I was saying from the very beginning, do you understand that opening up your space to be more accessible virtually makes it more accessible to people who historically have never been in an acting class, because you don't even know that you discriminate against them, us, right? From like Head Start and all of that. At some point, I kind of like gave up, because I don't have a position in my current institution or anywhere else really to say it loudly enough for the people in the back, you know, to actually hear me. But that whole frustration it's been ongoing in my life, but especially now it's intensified, because this is such an opportunity to open up your education to people who have been disenfranchised for centuries. And many people just don't take it and keep maintaining their ableist practices. And I just, I am very angry about that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So what has been the hardest part about living throughout this? And there can be certainly more than one answer to this as well.
I think the hardest part has been realizing how little resources I actually have in my life compared to what I thought I did. And that I'm not just referring to money, or material sort of resources, but also opportunities that, I don't know, throughout the pandemic, I just kept thinking about how the guiding sort of motivation of my professional life and personal life to some degree, right, has been throughout my life, has been my desire to be a professional in the performing arts, whether a performer or a director or any sort of, you know, creative, basically. I've always wanted to be a creative, and I have been a creative person and a creative professional. But unfortunately, I realized, especially throughout this pandemic, that even in this country, which is comparatively somewhat better in that regard to other places like I'm from, right? It's still too many doors are closed to me because it's such a complex system of networking and opportunity. So many opportunities come from not merit, but connections. And if you do not have certain connections, you don't have certain doors opening to you, or even you don't even know where the doors are. So basically, that's been a revelation that finally hit me. It's been kind of growing in my mind, you know, in the past several years, but I finally I think came to the realization that it's very difficult to get in the room where it happens. No pun intended, but you know what I mean?
Go ahead, sorry.
No, it's okay. I think that's been basically the hardest part, to just realize that my resources that are available to me, and again, I don't just mean the money, are less of the resources than I had thought. You know, so the feeling of the promised land not really being quite promising has been detrimental, really. But I think I'm going to say there has been a positive sort of upside to that, mm-hmm. is this pandemic really taught me to appreciate small moments. It sort of de-escalated my ambition, if that makes any sense, in a way that I realized that none of my ambitions have ever been really mine. They've been imposed by society or some expectation of somebody else. I'm coming to the realization that it's okay not to have ambitions professionally or otherwise. And it's okay not to be guided by these, you know, flashing lights of, I'm not even going to say fame or whatever, but like the cool stuff of whatever shape or form, you know, or going viral or whatever, you know what I mean? Like it's okay just to be a person. And it's great to be a person, and it would be great if the society saw us as people, but you know, one can hope. I think also the other positive, I think, thing is that I've been making efforts to learn more about disability community and how to communicate better within that community. In particular, like for example, with my art, I started writing image descriptions for every art that I post, and that's been absolutely terrifying because my art is very abstract. So for like doing that is like, it's very difficult, you know, but I know I want to do it because I want to be as helpful as possible and as accessible as possible in whatever I do. So that's been like an interesting, challenging kind of way, but not definitely not the hardest part, but maybe the best part. I don't know.
Yeah, that goes into my last question, which is really, have there been any silver linings to this? Which, you know, you already answered in some ways, but if you feel like you want to expand upon that at all,
I mean,
you don't need to.
Yeah, I just want to say that, you know, deep down, I know that the main silver lining is, as somebody like myself who has had multiple near-death experiences throughout her life, starting with the very beginning, I've had multiple moments in my life where I was forced to by the circumstances to stop and reflect on what the hell I'm doing. Like, and I've had many regrets, and I've made efforts at some point in my life to turn my life around to make it better, but at some point I didn't. But even though it was the moment of, you know, I could have died quite easily, but here I am, so why, right? Now I think is another one of those moments. It's less momenty and more prolonged, right, because of the time that we're in. But I am trying to find the positives in terms of just learning, I guess, more about myself and how I operate in the world and what is it. I think I became more unapologetic, or like I've always been unapologetic, but now I feel like I don't filter that out anymore as much, because even like bring it back to realistic things like applying for jobs and stuff like that, like I do the check mark now that I am, you know, in the questionnaire that they have, are you disabled or have you ever had a disability? I check yes now, because why do I have to, I don't want to hide it. You know what I mean? Like, if it matters to them, they're going to ask and I'm going to expand or whatever, but like, it's okay. Like, basically what I'm saying is, I think I'm finally realizing that it's okay to be me, both physically, literally, figuratively, or, you know, also in terms of my presence in the world. And it's okay to find a balance between who I really am and kind of let my actual drives through, you know, and not let the noise of the world shape who I am, because I don't want that anymore.
Yeah, that's really great in a, you know, even though it's like a really terrible situation, that's really great that, that you've been able to sort of embrace those different parts of yourself more. Absolutely. Okay, well, that's all I have. Do you have anything that you would like to add?
I would like to add one thing, is that I am truly and tremendously thankful for the opportunity to talk to you and to share my experiences. I have never been a part of any community for real, because all the communities I've been trying to be part of were kind of resistant to my presence or were undermining my existence even. Because of how ableist they are and all that. But I think it's been such a humbling experience to be witnessing the disability community discourse going on, but also knowing that I am part of it. And it's okay to be a part of this community, with even if I don't, you know, vocalize it or explicitly share it every time. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
What I'm saying is I don't feel like I have to have, you know, in my social media bio or something that I am disabled or identify as disabled necessarily to know that I'm part of this community, or vice versa, right? Like, I don't owe it to the world to explain myself. And I know that my community is accepting of me, and
absolutely,
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Thank you.
It's so great to have you. And yeah, I just think that, you know, these stories and experiences are so important to record and to document. And I think that, I think that disability is such a, it's such a changing category too, you know? So there's a lot of, I feel like, gray area. It's not really a black or white thing. And so, yeah, I'm really glad that this has been, you know, a good opportunity for you, a good experience for you. And that, yeah, I hope that you are able to continue to find, Yeah, just to feel more welcome in the disability community. Absolutely.
Thank you. I also, it just feels so surreal for me to be on this side of the interview, because I have interviewed hundreds of people over the course of my life for as a journalist, for my dissertation, for my research. And it's just, I keep wanting to ask you questions. Well, because I want to ask you questions, but also like, it's just so unusual. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to go ahead and stop recording.